Welcome to the online ministry of La Jolla United Methodist Church, a congregation of faithful Christians right along the Southern California coast. Together, we seek to grow in our individual spirituality and in connected community with one another. All are invited to join in this vibrant faith community. For more information, visit our website at lajollaunitedmethodist.org. May you be enriched in the hearing of these words, and may you receive and enjoy God's blessing.
Today is from Luke. Chapter 17, verses 11 to 19. On the way to Jerusalem, Jesus traveled along the border between Samaria and Galilee. As he entered a village, 10 men with skin diseases approached him. Keeping their distance from him, they raised their voices and said, "Jesus, Master, show us mercy." When Jesus saw them, he said, "Go, show yourselves to the priests." As they left, they were cleansed. One of them, when he saw that he had been healed, returned and praised God with a loud voice. He fell on his face at Jesus' feet and thanked him. He was a Samaritan. Jesus replied, "Weren't 10 cleansed? Where are the other 9? No one returned to praise God except this foreigner?" Then Jesus said to him, "Get up and go. Your faith has healed you." The word of God for the people of God. Amen.
Some of you noticed today that I wore my red Chucks. I wore my ordination shoes, the shoes that I wore during the actual annual conference worship service where I was ordained. I wore different shoes when I was commissioned. I don't wear those as much. They're a bit older and they're starting to wear out. The process to ordination in the United Methodist Church is, well, it's a lot. Pastor Tara was just ordained this past summer. It's a lot. The process varies a little bit depending on what region or annual conference that you're a part of. And yet I would suggest that no matter what, it is a rigid process. Once you have finished your educational requirements, for most of us that's a Master of Divinity degree. Once you have finished the ordination process, there is an examination process, and it is a multi-step examination process. Each region, each annual conference has a board of ordained ministry. Now, some of you know what it's like to have to be examined by a board of something in order to be licensed or approved for your vocation. And it's the same for us in some ways. In the United Methodist setting, particularly in this region, in the California Pacific Annual Conference, there is both a written section of the examination and then an interview section of the examination. When I finished seminary, I completed the written section, writing around 100 pages for that part of the examination, and then I went to an interview. There were three separate groups for the interview. One focused on theology. One focused on pastoral care and counseling, and also Christian education. The other focused on evangelism and discipleship making. And it was a thorough examination. So I graduated from seminary, Claremont School of Theology, with my Master's of Divinity degree in 2011. And then I... Along the time that I was doing all my finals for school, I was also writing papers and submitting papers. And then shortly after graduation, shortly before graduation were the interviews. In our region, if you don't do well on the papers, they're not going to take time for the interview. I did fine on the papers. I did mostly okay for the papers, and I went for the interview. I did not pass the examination that first time through. I was not recommended for commissioning on the way to ordination. And in hindsight, I would say that was the right decision, honestly. Sometimes we face examination and we don't agree with the results. In this case, I think the results were the right results. I don't think I was quite ready at that time. But I still felt called to be a pastor. And I called up my district superintendent and I said, I didn't pass the interviews. I would like to still be considered for appointment in a local church. Having achieved the stage that I had achieved, that would be appropriate. It's less likely because once you are commissioned, once you are ordained, the bishop and the superintendents are required to put you in a church. But if you haven't passed that examination, they are not required to do so. And so I said, well, I would like to be considered. And the superintendent was wonderful. She said, I can't. The superintendent, by the way, is someone some of you know, the Reverend Katie Coots. So, yes, some of you know Katie? Her dad, Bob, was appointed here. Good. All right. I contacted Reverend Katie, and I said, I'd like to be considered. She said, I can't guarantee anything, which was the right answer. She said, we're a connected church. Talk to some of the people that you know and see what possibilities there might be. And so both of those sort of separate pathways worked out. I ended up getting a call from a superintendent, not Reverend Katie, a different superintendent. And he said this to me, and sometimes I exaggerate, but I don't think I'm exaggerating on this part. Here's what I remember him saying. Well, we have a church for you. They can't really afford to... pay you. I think I can find the money somewhere, but it's a small church and you're really going to have to work hard to build up everything so that they can't afford to pay you. That was the first conversation. Oh. But there was another conversation. I mentioned that Reverend Katie said we're a connected church. So I sent letters to some people that I know, some clergy folks that I knew and others. And I got a phone call from my friend's dad. He said, we're doing something exciting. He said, in the town where I am, there are three churches of different sizes. And we feel like maybe instead of like that sense of competing with each other, maybe we can collaborate and cooperate with each other. Maybe we can be better stewards of the resources available to us, and we can be more effective in ministry if we can cooperate and collaborate, we three churches, instead of operating like we're all siloed off in our own, on our own and competing with each other. That second one sounded pretty exciting. There was one hang-up. It would mean moving to Nebraska. Now, you know my bio, and you know that I ended up moving to Nebraska. And I lived there for 3 years, and I would suggest it was absolutely, without a doubt, the best vocational decision I could have made, because it changed the way I do ministry, and it changed the way I preach. It changed so much about my outlook on ministry. It changed so much about how I feel so drawn to collaborative ministry, because friends, we're all in this together, and it was this experience in Nebraska that helped me to see that more clearly. Now, part of what that meant is we had to move to Nebraska. Now, it's one thing to pack up your stuff in a little, you know, three-bedroom apartment on seminary campus, you know, to move to another town in California. It's another thing to pack up all your stuff to move to the Midwest from the West Coast. And to move everything, we had movers, but we had to pack ourselves. We had to get it on a truck that we didn't schedule to a place that we had never seen other than through cameras and screens. And into a town where to that point we had spent a grand total of 72 hours. We didn't know where stuff was or how to get anywhere. And to kick it off, not only did we have to move there, but I had to plan to fly back because I was still scheduled to lead a camp. It was a lot of planning, a lot of detail. It didn't all go perfectly. And we got there. It was really hard. And it was a journey. And as I look back on that journey, I know that it was absolutely worth it. Even though when faced with the decision of staying in the place, in the state where I grew up, and that I knew where stuff was, and I knew how to get from one town to another, to a place where, goodness, my cell phone didn't even work because I was with a different company. And I didn't know how to get from one place to another. And I didn't even know where the grocery store was. And it was all worth the journey. And I wonder if you've had that experience too, where you faced something and there was a process and there was planning and there were details and you had to go through all the mud and all the stuff, figurative mud, to get to where you wanted to go. Maybe you didn't even have a clear vision of where you were headed. Maybe you didn't know all of what it looked like, where the grocery store was, for instance. But when you look back on it, in hindsight, all the difficulties of the planning and the journey were worth it. I hope you've had that experience. I really do. I hope you've had that experience. Maybe you've had more than one experience like that where you look back and, well, this part wasn't really worth it. But this part was worth it. I bring up this conversation about the journey and the details and the planning and everything that goes into something, and ultimately you find that it's worth it, but it's really hard to get there. Because this part of the Gospel of Luke that we're considering today is really, we might consider it the primary journey in the Gospel of Luke, as Jesus turns his face to Jerusalem. Jesus sets out for Jerusalem shortly after the Transfiguration. We celebrated Transfiguration Sunday not long ago. And that happens in the Gospel of Luke. It happens in the 9th chapter. It begins with the 51st verse. Not the Transfiguration, but the verse where Jesus sets his face to Jerusalem. He turns his way. He focuses his attention, his energy, his heart. He focuses on Jerusalem. And I would suggest, this is what I believe, I would suggest that Jesus did so knowing what would take place. I believe that Jesus set his face towards Jerusalem knowing that the end result would be arrest, well, betrayal, then arrest, torture at the hands of the occupying government, execution. I believe that Jesus set his face to Jerusalem with that in mind. And yet he did so with determination anyway. So in the 9th chapter of Luke, Jesus sets his face to Jerusalem. But what takes place later on? He gets to Jerusalem. But it's not until the 19th chapter. It takes 10 chapters between when Jesus sets his face to Jerusalem and when he arrives in Jerusalem. Like if you do the math, that's not quite half of the Gospel of Luke. It's about 40% of the Gospel of Luke, where Jesus sets his face to Jerusalem. Now, if you've been getting those daily text messages, if you've been following the daily readings, that's day 15 through day 28. That started on March 10th and you're still reading it now. You're not going to be done until March 25th. That's how much of the reading of the Gospel of Luke. And he shows this same determination, even knowing what is to come. So you imagine that journey that you've been on, where you know that you're headed in this journey and your focus is there. You probably have to take that time to really center your priorities. I'm not going to waste time on the stuff that's less important. I'm going to focus on the stuff that's absolutely important. And part of why I highlight that is because I believe, at least in my reading of the Gospel of Luke, these 10 chapters continue to show how Jesus lifts up the lowly. And he does this in a number of ways. I think we have some more slides on this. Those 10 chapters include some very familiar stories. Jesus is tested about the greatest commandment and tells the parable of the Good Samaritan. This is in Luke chapter 10. Now, we're going to talk in a minute about who the Samaritans are. But by Jesus telling a story where the Samaritan is the hero is mind-blowing for the Jewish community of the time. It is completely unexpected. How could it be possible for a first century Jew would say, how could it be possible for one of those people to be the good guy in the story? But just after Jesus sets his face to Jerusalem, this is the parable he tells. Where one of the most marginalized communities in terms of the Jewish tradition, one of the most marginalized communities is lifted up, is told, is talked about as the hero of the story. Now, it's also in this time period where Jesus visits Mary and Martha. It's also in this time period that Jesus teaches the disciples to pray the Lord's Prayer. Two different times in Luke 13 and 14, Jesus heals on the Sabbath. There's more. The parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector that we've talked about recently in Luke 18. This takes place in this time period where Jesus responds to a rich man's question and says this quote, "It's easier for a camel to squeeze through the eye of a needle than for a rich person to enter God's kingdom." That's Luke 18. And in Luke 19, which we'll talk about next week, Jesus meets Zacchaeus. All of these familiar stories, these stories that we remember, these stories that touch our hearts, these stories that are a part of our faith formation, take place in this significant section of the Gospel of Luke. Now, there are others. Jesus warns about his arrest in chapter 9. Jesus talks about loving your neighbor in chapter 10. Jesus condemns Pharisees and legal experts. That's in chapter 11. Jesus warns against greed in chapter 12. Jesus demands genuine change in chapter 13. I skipped one back at the end of chapter 12. There are conflicts started by Jesus I came to cast fire upon the earth. How I wish that it was already ablaze. That's a hard thing for folks to hear. That's in this section of the Gospel of Luke. Jesus talks about occasions for celebrations in such a way that Pharisees and legal experts continue to criticize him. Jesus expresses sorrow for Jerusalem. Jesus talks about faithfulness with money in chapter 16 with a parable. Jesus talks about, responds to Pharisees who are money lovers. The Pharisees who were money lovers heard all this and sneered at Jesus. That's chapter 16, verse 14. There is a lot that happens in this section. And continually, Jesus lifts up the lowly, and continually, Jesus gets into trouble with the Pharisees and the religious leaders. And what are some of the critiques that we heard from the Pharisees and the religious leaders? Just in those very brief examples, They're mad, it seems, in my interpretation, they're mad that Jesus continues to lift up the lowly, the tax collectors, the sinners, the prostitutes, those who are marginalized. And yet in this journey towards Jerusalem, as Jesus sets his face toward Jerusalem, he focuses on his highest priorities. And to my reading, that's lifting up the lowly and the marginalized. I think our next slides have to do with who the Samaritans are. Am I right about that, Cam? Ah, people with skin diseases. The text we read today, thank you, Steve, for reading the text today, has to do with people with skin diseases. What's up with people with skin diseases? We see people with skin diseases from time to time, don't we? Do we make them leave? Not necessarily, no, of course not. We have greater compassion. But in the Jewish tradition, in fact, coming from Leviticus chapter 13, those who have a skin disease, and remember that comes from the Greek word lepra, which is where we get the English word leprosy, they must wear torn clothes. They must. They must have disheveled hair. They must cover their upper lip. I don't know if that's with a mustache or what. I'm just not sure. It's unclear to me. They must cover their upper lip. And they must announce themselves. Can you imagine? Can you imagine what it must be like that any time you're near anyone else, you have to name your uncleanliness? Don't come near me, I'm unclean. No, don't get too close. I'm unclean. Every time you're near someone, can you imagine the ache and the longing for human compassion and companionship? To simply have someone look you in the eye and see you as a person, can you imagine how lonely they must feel? Can you imagine how, of course, people who are all suffering from a skin disease might gather together, maybe 10 of them, with that common experience. And yet even so, they must wear their clothes torn and their hair disheveled and upper lip covered. And any time someone who doesn't suffer what they suffer comes near, you must once again shout that word that I imagine might begin to feel like a profanity. Unclean. I'm unclean. Knowing that not only are you proclaiming that you have a disease that maybe you didn't have any control over getting, but that you are seen as someone who is not only physically contagious, but someone who is ritually and spiritually flawed, unacceptable, unclean. You can't go to the temple. You can't go to the church. You can't be, well, in this kind of community. There was no live stream that you could participate. There was no online chat where you could at least have some semblance of communication if you're sick. You were simply isolated and alone. And I would suggest that some of us have just a hint of that sense of loneliness as we continue to emerge from a time when we have had to isolate, when we couldn't come and gather in this place, where we couldn't hear incredible music in the way that we hear it, where we couldn't be in our favorite pew or gather on the olive tree patio. Again, I suggest that's simply a hint of what these persons endured. Now, as you heard the story, there were 10 people with skin diseases, and Jesus healed them all after they followed their appropriate duty of proclaiming their uncleanliness. They called out to Jesus, "Jesus, Master." They knew their duty. And Jesus looked. And can you imagine their sense of being lifted up as Jesus saw them and addressed them with compassion? Because I imagine that what they were used to is that flinching look where someone doesn't even want to get too close. But Jesus sees them. And he says words of compassion, and he tells them that they are healed. And he not only cares for their physical cleanliness, he says, go and show yourself to the temple priest. He's caring for their spiritual cleanliness as well. This is how someone is redeemed in the community after having a skin disease. If that skin disease goes away, you have to present yourself to a priest in the temple. Jesus says, go and do this thing. Enter back into community. And they all leave except one. Do you remember who the one is who comes back? Now, it doesn't tell us who all 10 of them are together. It doesn't say that they're all Samaritans. It doesn't say that they're all Jews. It just doesn't say. What it does tell us, what Luke tells us, is the one who came back is a Samaritan. The one. My reading is he's the only Samaritan in the group. And he is the one who comes back. He is the hero of the story. So what is it about Samaritans? I think we have a slide about this too. The division between Samaritans and Jews goes all the way back to this, the Babylonian exile in what, the 6th century AD, I'm sorry, the 6th century BC or BCE. The Babylonian exile, the Samaritans would say that they lived in the northern part and were not subject to exile the way most of the Jews were. And so when the Israelites came back, there was quite a bit of animosity between the two communities. There was anger and frustration between those who were forcibly removed and those who remained. If we continue to the next slide, Jews saw Samaritans as outsiders, as heretics, those who did not practice the faith correctly. In fact, we find a little bit of a highlight. I know it's not in the Gospel of Luke, but we find a little bit of the highlight between the differences in faith and spirituality between Jews and Samaritans in John chapter 4, where there is a Samaritan woman at a well, and Jesus actually speaks to her. We see some of the faith and spirituality differences in that conversation. Now, both Jews and Samaritans claimed that they were the ones who were the true descendants of the Israelites. They were the ones who practiced the faith correctly. They were the ones who did all the things right. They were the ones who were God's chosen people. Now, Samaria is located between Galilee to the north and Judea to the south. We have a map that we can show you. If you were a Galilean Jew and you wanted to go into Jerusalem for any of the annual festivals, you had two choices. You could choose to travel through Samaria, or you could choose to cross the Jordan, then come south, and then cross the Jordan again to get back to Jerusalem. A longer, more difficult journey. And most chose the longer, more difficult journey rather than go through Samaria. This is the relationship between Jews and Samaritans. We've heard the relationship between people in the community and those with skin diseases. This intersection of being both a person with a skin disease and a Samaritan, this person who could not possibly be any lower on the social scale, this person who could not possibly be the hero of any story, is the hero in Jesus' story, is the one who is lifted up and the one who acknowledges the incredible grace and healing that takes place. The 9 lepers who leave do so following Jesus' instruction to go and show themselves to the priest. But the one who is among the lowest in that society, he pauses. And he chooses to express gratitude, to acknowledge the remarkable gift that's been given. And in doing so, he becomes the hero of the story. Where once again, the lowest, the most marginalized, is the one who more fully acknowledges Jesus and more clearly points us today, 2,000 years later, in the right direction. Who today are marginalized people that we might have a tendency to ignore, to cast aside, to think they don't know what they're thinking about or talking about, who can point us to live more Christ-like lives? Perhaps it is remembering, as I said last week, that our youngest worshipers are not the future of the church, they are the church today. And maybe we ought to see things through their perspective. Do you remember when we sat in this pew here and saw this church from where they sit? Or maybe it's laying on the chancel, face down. I imagine, I said this to Pastor Tara, the one leper, the one Samaritan, the one person with skin disease who comes back and the way it says it in the text, falls on his face in gratitude. He's the hero of the story, and we might see Christ through his lens, or through the lens of a child in a pew, or even a child on the floor. We might see Jesus through the lens of one who has been gifted so much. How can we see Christ in a new way? In a way through the lens of those we often don't consider. And how will that change our view? Let the lowly guide us, and we too will be lifted up. Amen.